Hello, and welcome to Traffic Europe Radio, Europe's literary radio station free online. My name's Clayton McKee, and I'm so excited to be back with you this week to offer a bit of a change from our original broadcasting program. We're about to approach a major milestone that greatly impacted our project, and this week I wanted to share something a bit different to approach this historic moment. As many of you recall, in July of 2023, Traffic Europe lost its director, Andrew Singer. Andrew was the director of the project from 2014 when he began the project in Scotland. We are so happy to have seen the project continue and to grow and to evolve in ways that Andrew may not have even imagined. And we're excited to be trying to increase and grow and expand our audience, our collaborations, and our community as we continue. And in July, we're actually going to be starting a couple of new parts of the project that we hope that many of you will enjoy. And of course, in August, we'll begin accepting submissions for our first ever literary prizes. So stay tuned for that. But our project is very much in a growth mindset at the moment. And I think it's very important to reflect back as we approach this devastating loss that the project suffered last year, to be thankful for how we have continued to grow and to show respect to our origins and how we got here. So today, rather than have an audio interview with an author or a translator, I actually wanted to return to our very first issue of Traffic of Europe with the very first piece that ever showed up on our pages. Before I do that, I want to mention that we are still in full fundraising mode for our literary prize. Traffic of Europe will be fundraising throughout the rest of this year to hopefully earn some funds for this prize and help offset the financial costs that come with it. If you are interested in donating to this prize, you can go to the links in the show notes to check out our donations. You can donate at www.trafficaeurope.org/shop, or you can go to our GoFundMe page. The link for that is on our websites, or you can go to gofundme.com/f/literary prize. All the funds raised throughout this fundraising time will be put directly back into the literary prize to help offset cost of printing and shipping issue to winners of the prize, to funding the prize itself, and to helping broadcast the amazing work that wins, and to help support the amazing authors, translators, and artists who will be submitting to this prize. Before I get into the reading of this excerpt, I also just want to remind you that if you enjoy this reading and you'd like to hear more audio excerpts, you can consider becoming a member of Traffic of Europe. You can go to patreon.com/trafficaeurope. Eventually, we'll be adding memberships to our actual physical website. However, in the meantime, you can get all of this content at patreon.com/trafficaeurope. There we are curating an archive of audio readings of all of the works published in Traffic of Europe. They are done fully in English. When possible, we include the original language as well. However, most are done purely in English. And it's an amazing way to turn on an episode, sit back, relax, hear a bit about the author, their life, and their work, as well as the translator when available. And we also supply a bit of a summary about the work before we go into the reading. So you get a little glimpse into some European literature, and then you get to sit back and hear an amazing story. Today we'll be hearing the first ever publication of Traffic of Europe. So this is the first excerpt in the first issue of Traffic of Europe. The issue is titled Northern Idol. And it is a collection of amazing literature stories and poetry from the northern islands of Europe. So that's Scotland, the Faroe Islands, Iceland, and Norway. The first ever work published in Traffica Europe's pages is titled The Heart of Man, and it's by Jan Kalman Stefansson. Stefansson was born in Reykjavik in 1973. His novels are written from the same extreme viewpoint where man is left to his own devices, facing a world much greater than himself, a world that for him has neither cure nor love, but offers him only the changing seasons. Hjartamannsins, The Heart of Man, concludes the Icelandic trilogy. The trilogy begins with the novel Himnariki og Helvetti, Heaven and Hell, and is then followed by Harmur Englana, The Sorrow of Angels, which is then finished by Hjartamannsins, The Heart of Man. This finale to the trilogy centers around the ancient notion of the solitude of man in an Iceland made of fishermen and wind and the tenuous attachment to life. Because of this, man seeks friendship or love, even though he realizes that it is futile. This text is translated from the original Icelandic by Philip Rufton. And those are the words that you'll now be hearing. Words are not lifeless rock or gnawed and wind-whitened bones up in the mountains. Even the most mundane of them can grow distant over time and transform into museums that house the past, what is gone and what will never return. Meadows, manured hay fields. We're moved to tears by these words. Something snaps within us, as when we unexpectedly come across old photos and see faces long since lost in the earth or the sea. Where are the meadows? And we recall tranquil summer mornings so still and deep that we could nearly hear God. But we also recall the toil, the wet feet, the wet grass, newly mown. How tremendously we recall the fatigue. We recall what's gone and will never return. Recall so poignantly that we were once alive, that we could once hold hands, and that there were once childish questions. Once we were alive, once had names, and they were sometimes spoken in such a way that the deserts of life began to flourish with green. Once we were alive, but not any longer. What surrounds us is called death. Where are the meadows? Is your heart still beating? And how does it beat? Damn it all. The boy receives a letter in which he's asked about his heartbeat, as if living isn't enough of a trial. He wakes up each morning just before 6, reaches out and grabs a book, poems to read as he emerges from his dreams into the delicate morning, connecting night and day, dreams and waking with poems. There may be no better way for a person to wake up. Yet the questions don't go anywhere. What is he supposed to do with his life? Does he love Ragnheidr, whom he's met twice since returning from his journey with Jens, a journey that went all the way to the end of the world, through gloomy weather, through life and death? The first time they met on the street, and she looked at the boy as if he were nothing, and even a little less than that. The next day, he was about to enter the German bakery when Ragnheidr stepped out with Danish pastries for her father, Friedrich. Warm pastries were practically the only luxury he permitted himself, and Ragnheidr the only one who was allowed to buy them. And then she wanted to get to know the boy. I heard you nearly killed yourself on your journey with the drunkard. How could you ever think of dying before I left for Copenhagen? Jens is not a drunk, he said, feeling mildly dizzy. Her eyes are somewhat wide set, those gray eyes that can be cold as frost, as the blood of a cod. Between them dwells my fate, he thought. Nothing I can do about it. This is a new sweater, she said. Yes, he said. It's beautiful. They know how to clothe you. You've got dandruff on your shoulder, said Ragnheidr, brushing off his right shoulder. Is your heart still beating? And why? Life is strange. As far back as he can remember, education had been the promised land that echoed under and over his mother's letters. His only education until now had been in preparation for his confirmation, in 1 month of lessons with an itinerant teacher when he was 10 or 12 years old. Yet he was able to read and write fluently by the time the sea claimed his father, and he practiced writing whenever he could. scratch letters on ice, on moldering rafters in the roof of the cowshed, in the snow, at first without constraint, neglected as chores. The rafters barely held up against the weight of the words, and one morning, when people came out from the farmhouse, it was nearly impossible for them to step into the snow due to the sheer amount of words. The boy hadn't been able to sleep because of the moonlight. He had gone out while it was still night and started to write. 12 strokes of the switch for 3 days in a row, and no dinner brought him to his senses. He was beaten, not out of malice, but necessity. For in the first place, writing words in the snow or dirt is bad luck, and second, his chores went unattended in the meantime. And how were people supposed to live in this land if they had neglected their work? And what would happen to you? Who would employ you if word got around that you rode in the snow instead of worked? You'd soon end up on the parish. You'd be kicked at like a dog. So, welcome these 12 strokes. Let them teach you. They're not given out of malice, but necessity. Even care. But now he wakes up, does light chores, takes lessons twice a week from Jisli, the most educated man in the village. The county, even this quarter of the country, the headmaster himself, has English lessons twice a week with Hulda, occasionally arithmetic with Helga. He wakes up in the mornings, connects dreams and reality with poems. Reality where he's encouraged to get an education. What is distant has come to him. Yet he asks, why am I alive? Where is life heading? And then the boy receives a letter. Is your heart still beating? And if so, how? It's beating like that of a drowning man, a wingless bird. How the hell should he answer this? But of course it's important to receive a letter, to have a person consider it worthwhile enough to be willing to sit down and draw up words and have you in mind the entire time it takes to write the letter. To receive a letter indicates that you exist, that you're closer to being light than darkness. Admittedly, not all letters are good, and some should perhaps never have been sent, never have been opened, read. Some are full of hatred, accusations, they're poison that will deprive you of all your strength. They bring darkness and disappointment. There's a letter for you, said Andrea, with something of a sarcastic look. A letter, he exclaimed in surprise, because who should be writing him a letter? His mother sent him 11 letters. He has all of them. The 12th never came. It might be from Reverend Kiartan, he said nonchalantly and absurdly, of course. Why should Reverend Kiartan send him a letter? Why should an educated, intelligent man, the owner of a large number of books, show such an interest in his existence? Might be from Reverend Kiartan, he said, having just come into the cafe after an English lesson with Hulda, two English lessons behind him, singular, plural, the definite and indefinite articles, a table, tables, and apple, apples. Have you tasted an apple? Asked the boy as he wrote down the word for this spherical exotic fruit, as far from our everyday existence as Jupiter. No, said Hulda curtly, telling a lie. Tater sometimes gets apples from foreign sailors who've come here often and might be called acquaintances of his, but it's easier to say no. It's safer. No is a fort protecting her. No, she says, and you can't get any closer. No, said Hulda, glancing at the boy through the battlements, and he said, unable to refrain from doing so, is there a plural form of love in every language? A love, she said, loves, with a V. Yes, V, but you shouldn't write it down. It's not in the curriculum. Love isn't in the curriculum? No, just apples, she replied, glancing down to hide her smile. Reverend Kiartan, asked Andrea. He's in Vic, remember? Jens and I stayed there our second night. His wife's name is Anna, and she's nearly blind. Yes, no, the letter's hardly from him. It's from a woman, or at least a woman has addressed the envelope. A woman, he said in surprise. Oh, then that would be Maria from Vertrarstund. He took the envelope, gave it a quick look, and was taken aback when he saw the letters, their ardor, as if they were all running into each other. They're fighting, he added. The letters, he explained when Andreas asked, what? So, she's that ardent, is she? Said Andreas, smiling at the boy, who heard hardly anything over the pounding of his heart. Maria would never write like that. She's ardent, of course. Fires burn inside her. She cries sometimes about something she's lacking, without knowing what. Just feels as if she's lacking something, and then Jan holds her. His embrace is warm and strong, yet doesn't encompass the horizon. No, Maria would likely be more meticulous. She delivers only the best and would have made the letter smaller, to save space. She knows no other way. He looked at the envelope. Yes, he said, she's ardent. How does her heart beat? So ardently that herbivores in Africa look up. So ardently that the birds of the air are knocked off course. We can go over English a bit, said the boy to Andrea, who smiled widely, warming the boy with her smile, warming him so much that he was able to sit at the table, go over singular and plural in English without going mad with impatience. He sat calmly, now and then leaning closer to Andrea. She has such a warm scent, blended with the faint musty smell from her basement room, and twice she stroked his cheek with her weary fingers. These two people far out on life's sea of uncertainty, surrounded by heavy currents, he breathed in, Andrea, and the letter quivered as it touched his flesh. But now he's sitting in his room. Is your heart beating? Is your heart still beating? And if so, how? I'm sitting against the wall of the house, the same one you crashed into, you and the big man, Jens. It's sunny, and everything is very wet. Your feet get wet just by looking out. But now the sun is warm. You can give it that. The frost melts into the ground. That's why the ground is wet, as if it's crying. I'm sitting on a stool. I brought a book with me to read. I wasn't going to write you a letter. The book is a bit thick. It's called The Odyssey, and is age-old. Steinen said it was a classic. I expect that you know something about it. That's how you are. I noticed it immediately. That's why you know it's about the man who's trying to make it home, but who ends up in all sorts of adventures and catastrophes. In the meantime, his wife has to wait at home, albeit in a palace, and with enough to eat. It's warm there, and no one gets buried in the snow. Yet, it's probably no easier to exist there. It's probably no easier to wait in uncertainty, though the weather is good and the house doesn't leak. I would never believe it were easier. She has to wait, and doesn't even know whether he's dead or is just being unfaithful to her with other women. She just waits, composed and patient and faithful, while he undergoes adventures, and then a book is written about him. No need to tell me about women. No need to tell me about men. Then it crossed my mind to write you a letter. I guess I thought about you. I must have, but that doesn't have to mean anything. For example, I also think about the frost that melts into the ground and makes everything wet, makes all our feet wet, yet not yours. You, who had such good shoes, people here still talk about it. And then there are those American boots that apparently keep one's feet eternally dry. Not many people here believe it, but even if I think about you, it's absolutely meaningless. So much has been thought here in Iceland, ever since the country was settled 1,000 years ago. Yet some people never seem to think anything, simply never. Have you noticed that? The expressions of such people remind me of rotten, useless hay. I'm going to stop now. Sometimes I also think about horse trailers, about kittens, and about Jupiter, which is a very big planet, yet is still just a tiny speck of light in the sky. I also sometimes think about rain in China. I'm sure you're familiar with it. I think about all sorts of things. So even if I think about you, it's nothing remarkable. I'm sitting on a stool. No, I'd already mentioned that. The snow is melting on the mountain above me. You see how little happens here? Life here is just melting snow and frost. Is it any wonder that it crossed my mind to write a letter? I'm lying, though. Life here isn't just melting snow and frost. For example, the shop manager, Sigurdur, is drunker some days than others. Yesterday, he couldn't stand on his own 2 feet. The day before yesterday, he was so spirited that his wife had to lock him in the house. She seems to have some trick or other for keeping him inside when it's really necessary. That Hjalti, who was with you, still hasn't been found. The doctor and his wife sent some men over to Nes. What a place that's supposed to be. The men said that when they got there, they found no Hjalti, but that everyone was doing well. People can be so stupid. They might even be standing upright, but of course they weren't doing well. Maybe I should go there and never come back. I wonder if you've recovered. You two didn't look entirely well when you left. There was still a child in you, and particularly in the big man, Jens. He made it all the way home. His sister was so terribly happy. She's considerably better than us, from the sound of it. Now that I've come to the end of this sheet of paper, there's no more space. Nor can I spend more time on it. I know that I can't write. You don't need to tell me. My letters are as ugly and tattered as old hens. I think about you sometimes. It's good to walk up over the village where the tussocks are soft. You lie down between them and it's as if they embrace you. The boy is lying between them, looking at the sky. I think about you sometimes. Then it occurred to me to write you a letter, which means I'd thought about you. He lies there so long that the birds have started to become used to him. Even the red shank has calmed down. But I also think sometimes about a horse trailer, about kittens, and about Jupiter, which is a very big planet, yet it is still just a tiny speck of light in the sky. I also think about rain in China. I'm sure you're familiar with it. Helga bristles when he returns. What's the meaning of disappearing like that? There are things needing doing here, the boy replies with an indecipherable mutter, so pale and metal-headed that Helga says, well then, and sends him to the cafe. It's as if she knows how he feels, as if she understands his sensitivity. Sensitivity is my truest dream, says an old poem, a line that shines through time, and it's true. The essence of man is sensitivity. We feel it so desperately in the spring when existence is at the needle point of life and death. The song of the plover, that poignant sound, reminds us of it, and now and then, we're startled to hear it. It's why Ólafur sat down upon the mountainside in sleet and wept. He had to weep. He sensed man's truest dream while realizing how much distance there is between his dream and the world that he's created. And then it's evening. It's evening, and the weather is bad. Those who are able to be at home are at home, listening to the wind, reading The Will of People. Icelanders, it says, appear to have stepped up and sworn a solemn vow to live beyond their means, under the control of merchants, and then die in debt. Merchants rule our days, because we allow them to. People believe that it's an unconquerable law. Consequently, you don't stand together. Everyone lives for himself. And therewith, we nearly always fish using their hooks, not our own. Schooley owns a share in a schooner. His father-in-law is a wealthy farmer in a bountiful area south of the mountains. Schooley could afford to provoke us with his pen, having little to lose, which is different than us, who depend entirely on merchants and their goodwill. It's not like it isn't fun to read such things. It's titillating, exciting. A bit like when children go off somewhere to say bad words. It's good when someone gives others what for. It makes them tremble a bit. Dogs have to have the chance to bark now and then, says Friedrich. Then there's less chance they'll bite. It's evening, terribly windy, pelting rain, out of the question to open the windows. The cigar smoke hangs thickly in Friedrich's master bedroom, so big it's nearly a parlor. There are six of them. Friedrich, Reverend Dolvolder, Dr. Sigurdur, Jan, the factor of Leo's shop and trading company, the magistrate Laris and Hogany, the head bookkeeper in Trygvi's shop and trading company, and director of the savings bank, which opened 3 years ago. It's open for business an hour a day, 5 days a week. Laris had started talking about one of Schooley's articles. He's becoming more and more aggressive, said the magistrate, before listing various other articles, and Friedrich simply let them talk, allowed them to worry. He's grown dangerous, said Sigurdur, who always sits so bloody straight. Yes, Jan, excitedly sucking on a cigar. Schooley's what you call in Danish a skattefugl, a curmudgeon. And the other smile at the word, as if Tove were speaking through him. But then the door opens and a maid enters with more coffee, refills the cups, adds to the cognac glasses. She's young, moves lithely, like a urban water, never looks up. They don't get to see her eyes properly, those blue stones. And she doesn't let it perturb her, though they all look. Watch her as the fire works its way up their stiff cigars with a low hiss. But she's glad to get out of there. A fine piece of work, mutters Laris, to say the least, agrees Sigurdur. While Dorvaldur says nothing, having simply watched like the others. That was his praise. And then Friedrich says, at first waving his hand as if to brush the girl aside, her youth, the agitation that they all felt. Dogs have to be allowed to bark, then there's less chance to bite. But Schooley hit the nail precisely on the head, albeit in reverse. Most people spend more than they have. As witnessed clearly in the trading company's ledger, far too many die in debt, which is why we must keep a firm hand on things. Otherwise, all of society will resemble the ledgers of its people, full of nothing but debt. But never mind Schooley, he's no threat. It's Geir Pruder we need to worry about. Schooley hides nothing, is plain for all to see, which is underhanded. Truder causes a stir and is corruptive to good morals, no less. You remember how she got her hands on Kolbin's share when he lost his vision? Acquired a substantial majority in one of the village's best ships by inviting him to live with her? It doesn't cost much to feed blind wretches who also have plenty of their own money. Where's it supposed to go when they breathe their last, huh? She's clever and takes advantage of situations. She got a hold of Snorri's share in the ice house for a bargain 2 years ago, tossed him a pittance of a payment. He was and is no man to make stipulations and was surely overjoyed to get at least something out of it, while she tightened the noose around the ruffian's neck and is likely lying in wait now for his schooner. The Hope, if she hasn't already secured it. In her own opinion, adds Friedrich, has Tryggvi got his eye on Snorri's company? Ask Jan. He has to ask. Has been ordered to ask. Friedrich looks at him, smokes. The rain beats down on the house. It's a June evening. It's the very start of June, yet it's still dusky between the mountains. Gloomy weather. The wind picks up, the saltfish stacks are tied down tightly, there's hardly anyone out and about in this tempest, despite the day beginning beautifully, the sky full of sun and blue promises of calm and comfort, birdsong audible far and wide, nothing to hinder the transparent, motionless air. Flies buzzed over flowers and grass, saltfish covered the spit, the drying lots. Much had turned green and beautiful in the mountains. In the village itself, all was astir, naturally. There were shouts and cries and laughter and cursing and hands that moved. Lully and Oder were on a teardown in the hold of a ship. Its captain rode off with Gerpruder. "I could love this country," he said. They rode up onto a heath, down into another fjord, and into an empty, grassy valley. "There's good cover here," said Gerpruder, and he gave her a long look before saying that he could love this country. Everything was turning green, and it was still and quiet between the tussocks, between the blades of grass, between the mountains that gathered sunshine and shone. On such days, it's as if the birdsong can heal the wounds within us. They lay in the grass for a long time, found a hollow. Those who find good hollows during an Icelandic summer can't complain. Bliss awaits them. That is, if the birds let them be. The blades of grass move almost imperceptibly like rows of venerable statesmen, and the birdsong healed wounds. "I could easily love this country," said the captain, before adding, "I could easily love you." People say the most incredible things before achieving satisfaction for their desires, or during all that's been whispered. Breathless phrases, immensely deep promises that prove to be shallow and worth little when all is said and done. The orgasm done and gone, the penis no longer erect and quivering with ardor and the lust for life, but instead, slack, a dangling rag of skin between the legs. But the moment had passed when he said he could love her. They'd laid down and ripped off their clothing, which was in their way. It was unbridled passion. It was vehemence. The sky witnessed it. The blades of grass felt it. The mountains heard it, and it startled nearby birds. They were like wild animals. They were beautiful. But now it was over. They smoked, sipped from a flask, gazed at blades of grass. The sky, the mountain birds, and the captain said that he could love her. He lay with his head in her lap, and she stroked the hair back from his forehead. His eyes, those pure eyes from that strong, beautiful face, stroked the lips that knew so well how to kiss, knew how to speak words that were good to hear. "I know," she said. "You could love me," he said. He asked. He begged. "A woman in love is defenseless," she said, "and I can't take that chance. Besides, you're married. You love your wife. Continue to do so. Are you cruel, perhaps?" "No, but life can easily be so." And then he was sad, a bit like a child. This big foreigner, captain of a substantial sailing ship that Lully and Oder worked on emptying while its captain lay with Gerpruder among tussocks beneath the blue sky. "Did you get to put your arms around her?" repeated Lully, having to press his friend hard to get an answer. And finally Oder answered. He smiled. "Can a man love two women?" asked the captain. "I expect so," she said, her long fingers in his thick hair, "and perhaps even more if there's an ocean between them. But you don't know me, John. I'm just a diversion in your life, a little adventure on a long sea voyage, a little dusky adventure that awaits you here at the end of the world, and among such steep, high mountains that no one can see us. You couldn't love me, not if you knew me, were with me every day. My heart is an organ that beats because it can do no other. I'm a sea, John, and as the sea grants you freedom for a little while, I offer you adventure, a touch of sin. Yet those who venture too far out into such oceans and for too long find little but loneliness and death." A snipe whinnied close by. A plover replied with a poignant cry. "Are you so unhappy?" he asked softly. He asked tenderly. "You need to experience happiness to understand unhappiness. And don't look at me like that. No one needs to comfort me. There's nothing to comfort. Life is either victory or defeat, not happiness or unhappiness. And I'm going to be victorious in my own way." "How can you be victorious without happiness?" asked her captain, John Anderson, lifting his thick hands and stroking Guy Pritter's eyes, stroking tenderly, stroking as a man strokes something that matters a great deal to him. She took his hand, bit it lightly with her predator's teeth. "I'll tell you tomorrow, or whisper it to you, but now it's getting colder." And they both looked up at the sky. The blueness had darkened. The storm pounding Friedrich's house was approaching. "But if you want," she added, "and if you can manage again, I'm ready." "Only if I may love you," he said. "You may, but then leave your love behind when you sail away. Leave it here between the mountains. Love is not a thing that one lays aside." "Yes, this love is," she said, unbuttoning her blouse. She unbuttoned her blouse, and he beheld her gleaming white breast, those breasts that he could gaze at endlessly, that pursued him far out to sea, all the way to England, those breasts, that skin, that scent, those long legs that locked around him, and the pitch black hair that flowed like darkness over green heather and grass, those hoarse words that she muttered in his ear. "If I could only love you," he whispered happily, he whispered despairingly. "It would be only unhappiness and death," she whispered back, before forcing his head down to prevent him from seeing her face, seeing the black eyes that looked up at the sky that was growing restless, the sky that is so distant it seems at times to have sentenced man to solitude. And now the sky is heavy and restless, with dark rushing clouds. It's summer, yet dangerous weather hangs over us. In June, which be so bright that it seems we can see to the bottom of existence, even as if we can see eternity, friendly and huge in the distance. A storm, yet in June, it could certainly treat us more fairly. The wind breaks up the sea and all that is loose, blows away. Hand carts, shovels, promises, "Forgive me, but I don't love you anymore. The wind tore my love from me, blew it away." Horses stand on the moors, in some places completely exposed, turning away from the wind that lashes all of nature. They let the tempest pass over them, stare straight ahead, look forward to grazing again. The rain pounds on them violently. It pounds on the big parlor window in Gay Pritter's house. All four of them sit in the parlor, the boy beneath a dim lamp. "You've got to have light to see the pages." "Whither went the light? Who took it? Bring it back. We don't deserve this." He has to sharpen his voice somewhat for the three of them to hear, because all the words have to come across. That's how poetry is. Those are the rules. That's how it should be. Must be. Writing is a war, and maybe authors experience more defeat than victory. That's just how it is. Gisley had explained, losing himself in his explanation. There was a gleam in his eye, as if he were really alive. He'd read over the 5 pages that the boy had translated of Mr. Dickens' story, A Tale of Two Cities. It was the best of times, it was the worst of times. In this story, there are a few mistakes, few defeats, making the job of the translator more difficult, yet happier. The boy said nothing, had the 5 pages in front of him, in some places marked up by just the translation, the tireless work, anguish, sweat, joy, delicate movement between languages, shredded by the comments of the headmaster, who talked and talked. The boy looked at the pages, and the anger welled up inside him. It certainly would be nice to wad up those pages, make a big ball, and stuff it into Gisley, deep into his throat, that dark tunnel. "There's no need to vaunt yourself on compliments for me. Pride is poison," said Gisley, his voice suddenly prickly. "Compliments," exclaimed the boy, breaking into a smile without realizing it, his eyes still on the marked up pages. "Compliments," he repeated, "because it's called a compliment to tear apart a work into which you've put your all, your heart, lungs, breath." The boy looks in astonishment at Colbean, sitting right next to him, his eyes closed as if sleeping, though with his left ear turned toward them, catching every word. "Yes," said Gisley, "I call it a compliment to say that you've done quite a good job of this, in some places very finely done indeed. Absolutely extraordinary for an uneducated person. I would call that a compliment, wouldn't you? Call that a compliment from me." "Colbean," he raised his voice, looked over at the skipper, who had said nothing, displayed no reaction. "Absolutely right," muttered Gisley. "You're not here. What a wonderful talent to be able to vanish like that, a rare talent. You should give me some lessons." "I didn't hear it, the compliment," said the boy apologetically. "I just saw that you marked up everything, thought that it was no good." "Is that so? Do you think that?" "Yes." "But what was that smile of yours supposed to mean then?" "I was just thinking." "Thinking about what? What was so amusing?" said the boy embarrassed. "That it would be fun to stuff the pages down your throat." This comment, at which Colbean laughed, or at least emitted a noise like an old grouchy dog that finds something amusing, entirely unexpected. A nice piece of meat, an extinguished sex drive. And the boy reads these pages, had managed to rewrite them in time, followed just these suggestions, corrections, for the most part. Reads them as the rain pounds the world, pounds the house, pounds the horses, and the wind tears up the sea. He reads and tries to forget that, right now, the sea is breaching the embankments, flooding the earth in heavy torrents, and to top it off, there's this gale, as if to punish us for having enjoyed the light, the gentleness of the summer. "There's power in this text," says Helga, after the boy has read the 5 pages. These words, what he found in the language and used for bridge building so that others, as well as for himself, could seek out remote worlds, seek out life, feelings, seek out what exists in the distance, but of which we weren't aware. "Translations," Gisley had said, "it's hardly possible to describe their importance. They enrich and broaden us." help us to understand the world better, understand ourselves. A nation that translates little, focusing only on its own thoughts, is constricted. And if it boasts a large population, it becomes dangerous to others as well, because most things are alien to it, but its own thoughts and customs. Translations broaden people, and therewith the world. They help you understand distant nations. People hate less or fear less what they understand. Understanding can save people from themselves. Generals have a harder time getting you to kill if you have understanding. Hatred and prejudice, I declare to you, are fear and ignorance. You may write that down. He did so, wrote it all down, then went up to his room and corrected the translation, and has now read it over. He read it as the storm pounded the house. The rain lashed the village, the horses, the sheep, the earth, and turned the June light to dusk. He concludes his reading. "There's power in this text," says Helga. "Yes," says Greipeter. "Yes, there's power." And she looks at the boy. Even Colbein seems to hem something that can possibly be interpreted as a compliment. That curmudgeon who still hasn't let the boy into his room to view his library, 400 books, let alone loan him any, and although the boy hopes for a change every single day, he would never imagine asking out of the blue, never in his life. A man has his pride. He sits there in the parlor, having accomplished something, done what's important. Something besides pull fish from the deep, dig up peat, stack hay in the barn, and now while the sky quakes with the storm and ships fight against death, the sky quakes. The boy feels as if he matters. He who's been called a variety of names ever since his father drowned 10 or 12 years ago, who forgets everything, remembers nothing, hardly notices anything, forgets and loses things. "You would have lost it a long time ago," said the old woman in the farm where he grew up after everyone died that was supposed to have lived. "You would have lost it ages ago, that thing hanging between your thighs, if it wasn't attached to you." He's been called an idiot, an imbecile, a muttonhead, a lout, a plonker, a milksop, a wastrel, a wimp, a scoundrel, a poltroon, scum, and a loafer. The language is rich with such words. It's also easy to scold and humiliate. It takes neither talent nor intelligence, let alone courage. But it could be undeniably difficult at times to believe that a physically fit urchin, later an adolescent and young man, could take so long with some chores, could hardly remember anything that his hands were supposed to learn. He might have learned to tie a knot in the evening, and then came night, and when he woke up, his hands had completely forgotten how to tie it. "Chances are, you're just adult," an old woman said to him once, not out of malice, but rather astonishment. Yet now he's been complimented, which is no small thing for one who's been called many difficult names throughout his life. Words have influence. They can sink into you and leave marks, get a person to believe various things about himself. To receive such a compliment, and from these women, the boy is quite close to sobbing. "Another 5 pages in a week, can you manage it?" asked Greipeter, raising her wine glass to her lips, those lips that were kissed today, and that kissed. And then she was alive, in the deserted valley. She existed, she burned. The birds were startled, and the mountains took note of her. "Yes," says the boy, convinced, confident, happy I can manage it. There's zeal in his eyes. While outside the storm rages and the world trembles, it would probably be safer to tie it down so that it doesn't blow out into the darkness of space. Andrea lies in her bed in her basement room and listens to the storm. It's not her bed, admittedly, but Geiperter's, as is the entire house. She lies there and can't sleep, tosses and turns, doesn't know how she should lie, how she should live. The wind pounds the house, tears up the sea, which is dark and heavy and restless. Even the lagoon, which is usually still and even when breakers beat outside it, is tumultuous, and J. Anderson's ship rolls upon it, frighteningly, its hold empty. Lully and Odor had worked tirelessly, along with others, to empty the ship's hold of sacks, bags, barrels, and they succeeded. Continual work, many hands, things are often urgent here between the mountains. Life is in a rush. Or better put, people, not life itself. Which simply exists, is just there, like a flower, like music, like a dagger, like sleet, like an abyss, healing light. But whatever life is, extraordinary or commonplace, it was urgent that Anderson's ship, the St. Louise, be undocked. St. Louise, we don't know why she made a saint, this Louise whom the ship is named after, why she deserved it, what torments she had to suffer. Does a person have to suffer torments to deserve the name of a saint? Can't she be happy? Isn't it difficult enough in this world? Beautiful enough? Noble enough? But it was urgent that St. Louise be moved from the pier. Another ship was waiting on the lagoon, heavy with salt. Salt is needed to cure the fish, and Louise needed to be unloaded in haste. Yes, now the men had an opportunity to show what they were made of, work like devils and never quit. If their hands dropped off them with fatigue, They should just screw them back on. The foreman, Kjartan, was in his element. He's a great shouter, great at goading men. Sometimes they work at night, even until morning. And if someone grumbles, wants to go home, it's very well. Do as you please, but you won't be needing to return anytime soon. Scully has written pointed articles in opposition to this labor fervency. An energetic man, that schoolie, not quite an adept in style. His sentences aren't daggers, but rather hefty cudgels. It's amusing that schoolie should stand up to those devils, but it's not a whit amusing to lose one's job, to fall out of favor. Then it's a struggle to survive. Are you supposed to watch your children starve in the summer, drop dead from cold in the winter? No? Then unfortunately, it's better to swallow it all and work. Labor on as you're ordered. The St. Louis was emptied of everything that foreign countries have. Figs, aquavit, cotton, plain choice timber, coffee. There were even crates of apples. Otter dexterously managed to open one without being seen, stuck two apples beneath his coat, and now, as the storm tears apart the June light, howls over the houses, and makes the mountains rumble, the three of them sit there, Otter, Rackle, and Loli, at Otter and Loli's. They've sliced the apple, and slowly eat this fruit that has drunk in the sunshine and tenderness of faraway worlds. Rackle smiles. Dear God, how delightful it is to see her smile in a close-up. As the storm shakes this little house furiously, the world has turned into one continuous howl. Whence comes this savage power, now, when the month of June should be Plover's song of her existence? Otter had stopped in to see Rackle towards evening, after they'd finished unloading Louise. We saw what was in the offing, the darkening clouds, rising wind, a rumble or two from the mountains, as if it were too much for them to restrain their suppressed wrath. Otter wanted her to join them. What with the storm in the wings, at least foul weather, and he also had a little something that he and Lully wanted to share with her. Nor is there any need for you to be alone in such foul weather. But she's often been alone in foul weather, malicious winter storms, and she's never been afraid. The only storm she fears is the one in people. To be more precise, in men, which is worse, infinitely worse, when it's not enough to dress warmly. Take shelter. It penetrates you and fills you with anxiety, fear, fills your blood with maddening drone. Yet Rackle said nothing, of course, about the storms in men. She said stormy weather is just wind in a hurry. There's little to fear. Still, said Otter, it would be nice to have you visit, and she went with him, without having meant to, without having dared to. Something inside her made the decision, and justly watched her leave with Otter. Saw how they walked side by side. Now I'll lose her, he thought. She'll leave the basement, and then there'll be nothing more between me and the devil. Perhaps I should rent you in the basement, he said to his walking stick, which was leaning against the wall by the door, and naturally has no mouth, no eyes, no heart. It doesn't matter if you give it a name. Names don't change death into life. But the three of them, Otter, Rackle, Lully, eat apples, and she smiles, and Otter's heart takes many an extra beat, while out on the lagoon, St. Louise rolls horribly. This has been a reading of Jan Kalman Stefansson's The Heart of Man, translated into English from the original Icelandic by Philip Ruffton. Something that sticks out in this excerpt is the importance placed on translated literature. And I think that this excerpt, at its publication in Traffic of Europe, once again, the first excerpt of the first issue of Traffic of Europe, is so fitting for the mission. And that moment of translation is still so fitting for today. We hear the discourse of translation allowing people to discover new worlds, hear new stories, and make the unknown known. And with that understanding comes acceptance and comes a lack of fear. I think that is such an important lesson to still keep today. And I think that the excerpt itself has a lot of power in that regard. As we read it in English translation, we hear a lot of an Iceland that is struggling to persist, and a people that are doing the best they can despite being called names, despite being in debt, and despite being perhaps looked down upon or critiqued by others. This excerpt radiates ideas of acceptance and love and the complications that come with love when it doesn't go both ways. And I think, and I hope, that translation helps us realize that love can go both ways, whether the other is known or not. Thank you so much for listening to this excerpt reading of The Heart of Man by Jan Kullman Stephenson, translated by Philip Ruffton. Thank you so much for supporting Traffic of Europe, and have a great day.